to his mind now was sincere. He couldn't be sure that the execution had taken place.
I think I remember, said Constant.
Well, that man you strangled was your great and good friend Stoney Stevenson, said Winston Niles Rumford.
Malachi Constant wept as he climbed the gilded ladder. He paused halfway up, and Rumford called to him again through the loudspeakers.
"Feel more like a vitally interested participant now, Mr. Constant?" called Rumford.
Mr. Constant did. He had a thorough understanding now of his own worthlessness, and a bitter sympathy for anyone who might find it good to handle him roughly. And when he got to the top, he was told by Rumford not to close the airlock yet, because his mate and child would be up shortly. Constant sat on the threshold of his spaceship at the top of the ladder, and listened to Rumford's brief sermon about Constant's dark mate, about the one-eyed, gold-toothed woman called Bee. Constant did not listen closely to the sermon. His eyes saw a larger, more comforting sermon in the panorama of town, bay, and islands so far below. The sermon of the panorama was that even a man without a friend in the universe could still find his home planet mysteriously, heartbreakingly beautiful.
"I shall tell you now," said Winston Niles Rumford in his treetop so far below Malachi Constant. "About B, the woman who sells Malachi's outside the gate. The dark woman who, with her son, now glowers at us all. While she was en route to Mars so many years ago, Malachi Constant forced his attention on her, and she bore him this son. Before then, she was my wife and the mistress of this estate. Her true name is Beatrice Rumford."
A groan went up from the crowd. Was it any wonder that the dusty puppets of other religions had been put away for want of audiences, that all eyes were turned toward Newport? Not only was the head of the Church of God the Utterly Indifferent capable of telling the future and fighting the cruelest inequalities of all, inequalities in luck, but his supply of dumbfounding new sensations was inexhaustible. He was so well supplied with great material that he could actually let his voice trail off as he announced that the one-eyed, gold-toothed woman was his wife and that he had been cuckolded by Malachi Constant.
"I now invite you to despise the example of her life, as you have so long despised the example of Malachi Constant," he said up in his treetop mildly. "Hang her alongside Malachi Constant from your window blinds and light fixtures, if you will. The excesses of Beatrice were excesses of reluctance," said Rumford. "As a younger woman, she felt so exquisitely bred as to do nothing to allow nothing to be done to her, for fear of contamination. Life, for Beatrice as a younger woman, was too full of germs and vulgarity to be anything but intolerable. We of the Church of God the Utterly Indifferent damn her as roundly for refusing to risk her imagined purity in living as we damn Malachi Constant for wallowing in filth. It was implicit in Beatrice's every attitude that she was intellectually, morally, and physically what God intended human beings to be when perfected, and that the rest of humanity needed another 10,000 years in which to catch up. Again, we have a case of an ordinary and uncreative person's tickling God's almighty pink. The proposition that God Almighty admired Beatrice for her touch-me-not breeding is at least as questionable as the proposition that God Almighty wanted Malachi Constant to be rich. Mrs. Rumford," said Winston Niles Rumford up in his treetop, I now invite you and your son to follow Malachi Constant into the spaceship bound for Titan. Is there something you would like to say before you leave?"
There was a long silence in which mother and son drew closer together and looked, shoulder to shoulder, at a world much changed by the news of the day.
"Are you planning to address us, Mrs. Rumford?"
said Rumford up in his treetop.
"Yes," said Beatrice, "but it won't take me long. I believe everything you say about me is true, since you so seldom lie. But when my son and I walk together to that ladder and climb it, we will not be doing it for you or for your silly crowd. We will be doing it for ourselves. And we will be proving to ourselves, and to anybody who wants to watch, that we aren't afraid of anything. Our hearts won't be breaking when we leave this planet. It disgusts us, at least as much as we, under your guidance, disgust it." "I do not recall the old days," said Beatrice, "when I was mistress of this estate, when I could not stand to do anything or to have anything done to me. But I loved myself the instant you told me I'd been that way. The human race is a scummy thing, and so is Earth. And so are you."
Beatrice and Chrono walked quickly over the catwalks and ramps to the ladder, climbed the ladder. They brushed past Malachi Constant in the doorway of the spaceship without any sort of greeting. They disappeared inside. Constant followed them into the spaceship and joined them as they considered the accommodations. The condition of the accommodations was a surprise, and would have been a surprise to the custodians of the estate in particular. The spaceship, seemingly inviolable, at the top of a shaft in sacred precincts patrolled by watchmen, had plainly been the scene of one or perhaps several wild parties. The bunks were all unmade. The bedding was rumpled, twisted, and wadded. The sheets were stained with lipstick and shoe polish. Fried clams crunched greasily underfoot. 2 quart bottles of Mountain Moonlight, 1 pint of Southern Comfort, and 12 cans of Narragansett lager beer, all empty, were scattered through the ship. 2 names were written in lipstick on the white wall by the door, Bud and Sylvia. And from a flange on the central shaft in the cabin hung a black brassiere. Beatrice gathered up the bottles and beer cans. She dropped them out the door. She took the brassiere down and fluttered it out of the doorway, awaiting a favorable wind. Malachi Constant, sighing and shaking his head and mourning Stony Stevenson, used his feet for push brooms. He scuffed the fried clams toward the door. Young Chrono sat on a bunk, rubbing his good luck piece.
"Let's go, Mom," he said tautly. "For crying out loud, let's go!"
Beatrice let go of the brassiere. A gust caught it, carried it over the crowd, hung it in a tree next to the tree in which Rumford sat.
"Goodbye, all you clean and wise and lovely people," said Beatrice.
Chapter 12. The Gentleman from Tralfamador.
"In a punctual way of speaking, goodbye."
Winston Niles Rumford. Saturn has 9 moons, the greatest of which is Titan. Titan is only slightly smaller than Mars. Titan is the only moon in the solar system that has an atmosphere. There is plenty of oxygen to breathe. The atmosphere of Titan is like the atmosphere outside the back door of an Earthling bakery on a spring morning. Titan has a natural chemical furnace at its core that maintains a uniform air temperature of 67 degrees Fahrenheit. There are 3 seas on Titan, each the size of Earthling Lake, Michigan. The waters of all 3 are fresh and emerald clear. The names of the 3 are the Winston Sea, the Nile Sea, and the Rumford Sea. There is a cluster of 93 ponds and lakes, incipiently a 4th sea. The cluster is known as the Kazakh Pools. Connecting the Winston Sea, the Nile Sea, the Rumford Sea, and the Kazakh Pools are three great rivers. These rivers, with their tributaries, are moody, variously roaring, listless, and torn. Their moods are determined by the wildly fluctuating tugs of eight fellow moons, and by the prodigious influence of Saturn, which has 95 times the mass of Earth. The three rivers are known as the Winston River, the Niles River, and the Rumford River. There are woods and meadows and mountains. The tallest mountain is Mount Rumford, which is 9,571 feet high. Titan affords an incomparable view of the most appallingly beautiful things in the solar system, the rings of Saturn. These dazzling bands are 40,000 miles across and scarcely thicker than a razor blade. On Titan, the rings are called Rumford's Rainbow. Saturn describes a circle around the sun. It does it once every 29 and a half Earthling years. Titan describes a circle around Saturn. Titan describes, as a consequence, a spiral around the sun. Winston Niles Rumford and his dog Kazakh were wave phenomena, pulsing in distorted spirals, with their origins in the sun and their terminals in Betelgeuse. Whenever a heavenly body intercepted their spirals, Rumford and his dog materialized on that body. For reasons as yet mysterious, the spirals of Rumford, Kazakh, and Titan coincided exactly. So Rumford and his dog were permanently materialized on Titan. Rumford and Kazakh live there on an island 1 mile from shore in the Winston Sea. Their home was a flawless reproduction of the Taj Mahal in Earthling India. It was built by Martian labor. It was Rumford's wry fancy to call his Titan home Dunromin. Before the arrival of Malachi Constant, Beatrice Rumford, and Chrono, there was only one other person on Titan. That other person was named Salo. He was old. Salo was 11 million Earthling years old. Salo was from another galaxy, from the small Magellanic Cloud. He was 4.5 feet tall. Salo had skin with the texture and color of the skin of an Earthling tangerine. Salo had three light deer-like legs. His feet were of an extraordinary interesting design, each being an inflatable sphere. By inflating these spheres to the size of German bat balls, Salo could walk on water. By reducing them to the size of golf balls, Salo could bound over hard surfaces at high speeds. When he deflated the spheres entirely, his feet became suction cups. Salo could walk up walls. Salo had no arms. Salo had three eyes, and his eyes could perceive not only the so-called visible spectrum, but infrared and ultraviolet and X-rays as well. Salo was punctual. That is, he lived one moment at a time. And he liked to tell Rumford that he would rather see the wonderful colors at the far ends of the spectrum than either the past or the future. This was something of a weasel, since Salo had seen, living a moment at a time, far more of the past and far more of the universe than Rumford had. He remembered more of what he had seen, too. Salo's head was round and hung on gimbals. His voice was an electric noisemaker that sounded like a bicycle horn. He spoke 5,000 languages, 50 of them Earthling languages, 31 of them dead Earthling languages. Salo didn't live in a palace, though Rumford had offered to have one built for him. Salo lived in the open, near the spaceship that had brought him to Titan 200,000 years before. His spaceship was a flying saucer, the prototype for the Martian invasion fleet. Salo had an interesting history. In the Earthling year 483,441 BC, he was chosen by popular telepathic enthusiasm as the most handsome, healthy, clean-minded specimen of his people. The occasion was the 100 millionth anniversary of the government of his home planet in the small Magellanic Cloud. The name of his home planet was Tralfamador, which old Salo once translated for Rumford as meaning both all of us and the number 541. The length of a year on his home planet, according to his own calculations, was 3.6162 times the length of an Earthling year. So the celebration in which he participated was actually in honor of a government 361,620,000 Earthling years old. Salo once described this durable form of government to Rumford as hypnotic anarchy, but declined to explain its workings. "Either you understand at once what it is," he told Rumford, "or there is no sense in trying to explain it to you, Skip." His duty, when he was elected to represent Tralfamador, was to carry a sealed message from one rim of the universe to the other. The planners of the ceremonies were not so deluded as to believe that Salo's projected route spanned the universe. The image was poetic, as was Salo's expedition. Salo would simply take the message and go as fast and as far as the technology of Tralfamador could send him. The message itself was unknown to Salo. It had been prepared by what Salo described to Rumford as a kind of university. Only nobody goes to it. There aren't any buildings, isn't any faculty. Everybody's in it, and nobody's in it. It's like a cloud that everybody has given a little puff of mist to. And then the cloud does all the heavy thinking for everybody. I don't mean there's really a cloud. I just mean it's something like that. If you don't understand what I'm talking about, Skip, there's no sense in trying to explain it to you. All I can say is, there aren't any meetings. The message was contained in a sealed lead wafer that was 2 inches square and 3/8 inch thick. The wafer itself was contained in a gold mesh reticule, which was hung on a stainless steel band clamped to the shaft that might be called Salo's neck. Salo had orders not to open the reticule and wafer until he arrived at his destination. His destination was not Titan. His destination was in a galaxy that began 18 million light-years beyond Titan. The planners of the ceremonies in which Salo had participated did not know what Salo was going to find in the galaxy. His instructions were to find creatures in it somewhere, to master their language, to open the message, and to translate it for them. Salo did not question the good sense of his errand, since he was, like all Tralfamadorians, a machine. As a machine, he had to do what he was supposed to do. Of all the orders Salo received before taking off from Tralfamador, the one that was given the most importance was that he was not, under any circumstances, to open the message along the way. This order was so emphasized that it became the very core of the little Tralfamadorian messenger's being. In the Earthling year 203,117 BC, Salo was forced down in the solar system by mechanical difficulties. He was forced down by a complete disintegration of a small part in his ship's power plant, a part about the size of an Earthling beer can opener. Salo was not mechanically inclined, and so had only a hazy idea as to what the missing part looked like or was supposed to do. Since Salo's ship was powered by UWTB, the Universal Will to Become, its power plant was nothing for a mechanical dilettante to tinker with. Salo's ship wasn't entirely out of commission. It would still run, but limpingly, at only about 68,000 miles an hour. It was adequate for short hops around the solar system, even in its crippled condition, and copies of the crippled ship did yeoman service for the Martian war effort. But the crippled ship was impossibly slow for the purposes of Salo's intergalactic errand. So old Salo holed up on Titan, and he sent home to Tralfamador word of his plight. He sent the message home with the speed of light, which meant that it would take 150,000 Earthling years to get to Tralfamador. He developed several hobbies that helped him to pass the time. Chief among these were sculpture, the breeding of titanic daisies, and watching the various activities on Earth. He could watch the activities on Earth by means of a viewer on the dash panel of his ship. The viewer was sufficiently powerful to let Salo follow the activities of Earthling ants if he so wished. It was through this viewer that he got his first reply from Tralfamador. The reply was written on Earth in huge stones on a plain in what is now England. The ruins of the reply still stand and are known as Stonehenge. The meaning of Stonehenge in Tralfamadorian, when viewed from above, is replacement part being rushed with all possible speed. Stonehenge wasn't the only message old Salo had received. There had been four others, all of them written on Earth. The Great Wall of China means, in Tralfamadorian, when viewed from above, be patient, we haven't forgotten about you. The Golden House of the Roman Emperor Nero meant, we are doing the best we can. The meaning of the Moscow Kremlin when it was first walled was, you will be on your way before you know it. The meaning of the Palace of the League of Nations in Geneva, Switzerland is, pack up your things and be ready to leave on short notice. Simple arithmetic will reveal that these messages all arrived with speeds considerably in excess of the speed of light. Salo had sent his message of distress home with the speed of light, and it had taken 150,000 years to reach Tralfamador. He had received a reply from Tralfamador in less than 50,000 years. It is grotesque for anyone as primitive as an Earthling to explain how these swift communications were effected. Suffice it to say, in such primitive company, that the Tralfamadorians were able to make certain impulses from the universal will to become echo through the vaulted architecture of the universe with about 3 times the speed of light. And they were able to focus and modulate these impulses so as to influence creatures far, far away and inspire them to serve Tralfamadorian ends. It was a marvelous way to get things done in places far, far away from Tralfamador. It was easily the fastest way. But it wasn't cheap. Old Salo was not equipped himself to communicate and get things done in this way, even over short distances. The apparatus and the quantities of universal will to become used in the process were colossal, and they demanded the service of thousands of technicians. And even the heavily powered, heavily manned, heavily built apparatus of Tralfamador was not particularly accurate. Old Salo had watched many communications failures on Earth. Civilizations would start to bloom on Earth, and the participants would start to build tremendous structures that were obviously to be messages in Tralfamadorian. And then the civilizations would poop out without having finished the messages. Old Salo had seen this happen hundreds of times. Old Salo had told his friend Rumford a lot of interesting things about the civilization of Tralfamador, but he had never told Rumford about the messages and the techniques of their delivery. All that he had told Rumford was that he had sent home a distress message, and that he expected a replacement part to come any day now. Old Salo's mind was so different from Rumford's that Rumford couldn't read Salo's mind. Salo was grateful for that barrier between their thoughts, because he was mortally afraid of what Rumford might say if he found out that Salo's people had so much to do with gumming up the history of Earth. Even though Rumford was chronosynclastic infundibulated and might be expected to take a larger view of things, Salo had found Rumford to be, still, a surprisingly parochial Earthling at heart. Old Salo didn't want Rumford to find out what the Tralfamadorians were doing to Earth, because he was sure that Rumford would be offended, that Rumford would turn against Salo and all Tralfamadorians. Salo didn't think he could stand that, because he loved Winston Niles Rumford. There was nothing offensive in this love. That is to say, it wasn't homosexual. It couldn't be, since Salo had no sex. He was a machine, like all Tralfamadorians. He was held together by cotter pins, hose clamps, nuts, bolts, and magnets. Salo's tangerine-colored skin, which was so expressive when he was emotionally disturbed, could be put on or taken off like an Earthling windbreaker. A magnetic zipper held it shut. The Tralfamadorians, according to Salo, manufactured each other. No one knew for certain how the first machine had come into being. The legend was this. Once upon a time on Tralfamador, there were creatures who weren't anything like machines. They weren't dependable. They weren't efficient. They weren't predictable. They weren't durable. And these poor creatures were obsessed by the idea that everything that existed had to have a purpose, and that some purposes were higher than others. These creatures spent most of their time trying to find out what their purpose was. And every time they found out what seemed to be a purpose of themselves, the purpose seemed so low that the creatures were filled with disgust and shame. And, rather than serve such a low purpose, the creatures would make a machine to serve it. This left the creatures free to serve higher purposes. But whenever they found a higher purpose, the purpose still wasn't high enough. So machines were made to serve higher purposes too. And the machines did everything so expertly that they were finally given the job of finding out what the highest purpose of the creatures could be. The machines reported, in all honesty, that the creatures couldn't really be said to have any purpose at all. The creatures thereupon began slaying each other, because they hated purposeless things above all else. And they discovered that they weren't very good at slaying. So they turned that job over to the machines too. And the machines finished up the job in less time than it takes to say, Tralfamador. Using the viewer on the dash panel of his spaceship, old Salo now watched the approach to Titan of the spaceship carrying Malachi Constant, Beatrice Rumford, and their son Chrono. Their ship was set to land automatically on the shore of the Winston Sea. It was set to land amid 2 million life-size statues of human beings. Salo made the statues at the rate of about 10 an Earthling year. The statues were concentrated in the region of the Winston Sea because the statues were made of titanic peat. Titanic peat abounds by the Winston Sea, only 2 feet under the surface soil. Titanic peat is a curious substance.